The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. In this week's edition, how British manufacturing is being killed off, why the Vatican is engaged in a tit-for-tat spat with the Trump administration, and the depressing reality of sex parties.
First, in our cover this week, Matthew Lynn explores the death of British manufacturing. He writes that the country that birthed the Industrial Revolution has not just moved into a post-industrial society, but it runs the risk of becoming a zero-industrial society. Well, Matthew joined us to discuss his argument alongside Paul Nowak, the General Secretary of the TUC. I started by asking Matthew just how bad the situation is and who's to blame.
Big question. I think in the piece I did this week, I was just trying to pull together various things. You know, you kind of like, you see all these individual stories coming out. Like we see, you know, some of the car factories closing. We see like INEOS closing its ethanol plant up in Scotland in Grangemouth with Sir Jim Ratcliffe, you know, talking about a catastrophe for British manufacturing. We see people like Airbus and JCB, who are some of the best companies in the UK, you know, closing factories or cutting back on jobs. And, you know, you get these individual stories, you know, coming out on a kind of weekly basis or a daily basis. But what I was trying to do was step back a little bit from that and piece it all together. And you're seeing really quite dramatic collapses in manufacturing. So if you look at some of the statistics in things like chemicals since the pandemic, down by 40%, in electrical engineering, down by 30%. Or so. And these are big numbers. And if you look at the kind of long-term trends, you know, obviously, you know, we had the big kind of Thatcher deindustrialization from the Thatcher era in the 1980s. But actually, manufacturing in the UK had been pretty stable at around 8-9% of GDP, depending a little bit on how you count the figures, for quite a long time. And a lot of it was, you know, quite good. You know, we weren't going to go back to being the workshop of the world. That was a long time in the past. We probably weren't going to do mass manufacturing like we maybe did, you know, 50, 60 years ago. That's in the past as well. But we had a fairly stable, healthy manufacturing industry. But if you look at the last 2 or 3 years, it's really fallen off a cliff. And I kind of coined the phrase, you know, we used to talk about the post-industrial society. And now we've kind of gone a step beyond that. We're talking about a zero industrial society, where if you look at the current trends, you know, we almost make nothing. And we can talk about this in a minute when we go on to this kind of broader discussion, you know, but that matters. That matters. It matters for two reasons. One is, you know, 8-9% of GDP. You can't lose 8-9% of GDP just like that. You know, it's a catastrophe. It's an economic catastrophe. But secondly, you know, manufacturing, you know, has lots of benefits. We're not talking about, you know, the kind of manufacturing which we kind of got rid of in the past, you know, the shipbuilding and some of the steel making, which, you know, was kind of naturally going to happen in Korea and China and was hooked on subsidies and state control. It probably didn't really have a future. We're talking about really quite healthy companies that should be able to operate successfully in the UK, that generate a lot of jobs, that generate a lot of technology, that have a lot of skills, generate a lot of exports. So, you know, the kind of two big points is it's in rapid collapse. And I think we have to start paying attention to that. And two, it's bad for the economy, and it's probably bad for society as well.
Paul, what do you make of Matthew's assessment? Is he being pessimistic there, or do you think actually, unfortunately, that's a pretty accurate representation of the situation?
Well, listen, I'm not complacent about the future of our manufacturing industry at all, and we're going to be fighting hard to make sure that Britain does have an industrial future. I think there is a real danger of talking down British manufacturing. We've still got a significant manufacturing base. We've got some absolutely world-class companies that Matthew's mentioned, companies like Rolls-Royce. And what I hope we'll see from the government is support to help those companies to grow and to grow new manufacturing and engineering companies. But you asked the question before, Will, who's to blame? No big spoiler or surprise here. I mean, I think the last government's got to take a lot of responsibility. We had a decade and a half with a complete absence, near enough, of industrial strategy. Maybe a brief flourish when Greg Clark was in the Department of Business, but it had a practical impact. So, I mean, look at one of the issues that Labour inherited, Port Talbot. Back in 2021, I was sat around a virtual table with Kwasi Kwarteng, when he was the Secretary of State for Business, and the steel unions, and we were making the case that we needed a plan for steel, for the future of green steel in the UK. Kwasi Kwarteng was quite supportive of that because he wanted an announcement to make at the Glasgow COP summit that year. And then when we got to the summit and that came and went without an announcement, the government completely lost interest. And I think that there was no serious industrial strategy. And I talk to manufacturing employers on a regular basis. I visit lots of workplaces, talk to our members, talk to managers, and that would be a common theme. So last government's complete absence of manufacturing strategy, it's not the only thing. Brexit has definitely had an impact on supply chains in part of manufacturing. Energy costs have played a part in our energy intensive industries. And I think, to be honest with you as well, everybody fell a little bit victim in the last couple of years, the time period that Matthew's talking about, to the internal psychodrama that was happening in the Conservative Party, because people weren't interested in seriously thinking about how we're going to grow businesses and support. I mean, it won't surprise you, unions found it hard to get an audience during those last couple of years, but I was talking to employers as well. They said, we can't make an investment decision because we don't know what the government's going to do in terms of support. You know, so we had explosion of offshore wind, for example, with very little built here in the UK. I mean, the second biggest offshore wind market in the world after China, and we bring in turbines from the Far East and from other parts of Europe, and limited impact on UK supply chain. So it's a complicated picture, but as I say, I'm keen not to talk down manufacturing, because I think with a proper industrial strategy, real smart investment, and a focus on industry, you know, we want to get to net zero, but not at the expense of deindustrialising the UK economy.
Well, on that final point, we interviewed Gary Smith, another prominent trade unionist, for the magazine last year, and he was quite critical at how climate targets, he says, that they're coming at the cost of British industry. So, where do you stand on the question of climate targets? Are you wary of them?
Yeah, well, listen, I think Gary's got absolutely legitimate concerns. And I mean, across all of our unions, public and private sector, we want to get to net zero, but we want to get to net zero in a way that protects and creates and sustains good quality jobs. And, you know, I mean, Matthew talked before about what happened in our previous waves of deindustrialization. I grew up in Merseyside in the 80s and 90s and saw firsthand what that deindustrialization meant to those communities. So I think if you're working in oil and gas or in energy intensive industries, you've got absolutely the legitimate right to say to government and to your employer, what does this mean for my job? What does it mean for my community? And so that's why, I mean, a couple of things I'd say on that, Will. First of all, yesterday we saw the beginnings of the government sort of addressing those issues. So they produced something called a sort of skills passport to allow oil and gas workers to move more easily into areas like offshore wind. That's a good first step. Is it enough in and of itself? Absolutely not. We've got the launch of the Industrial Strategy Council. The TUC, my colleague Kate Bell will sit on the Industrial Strategy Council. For us, the measure of that Industrial Strategy Council is, does it produce, create, sustain good quality jobs? And as I say, I mean, that's the starting point for me. So absolutely get to net zero, but I want the voices of those workers in oil and gas, in steel, in chemicals, in cement at the heart of those discussions, because there potentially is 800,000 jobs in our energy intensive industries that are at risk if we don't get this right. And that means addressing things like energy costs in the short term, not just in the long term through Great British Energy and so on. But it does mean centering workers' voices in that debate about net zero.
Matthew, Paul mentioned there things like such as the skills passport and other things that this new government, this Labour government, is starting to do. It's obviously still quite early days, but what do you think about the prospect of British manufacturing now that we have got a change of government? Are there signs that Labour is going to do anything differently or better?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say yes, but unfortunately not, which at least will spark a debate, a smarter debate with Paul. I think he's absolutely accurate that the last government, I'm not going to defend them, they were completely useless, particularly where on many of the economic issues and certainly where industry was concerned. So, you know, and it's far too early in the process to say, it's been going on, particularly for the last 3 or 4 years. I think it's really accelerated into quite a rapid decline, as I was kind of outlining in the piece. And most of that happened under the Tories. So, you don't want to get too much much of a party political point, but I think it's getting worse under this government under the first 6 months. So if you take, you know, Paul mentioned electricity prices, they're absolutely crucial. You know, we're up to 50% more expensive or so roughly than the United States on industrial electricity. And if you take just a very basic industry like cement, I mean, everyone needs cement for most things that get done. You know, it's 50% of the production cost, sometimes 60% of the production cost is the cost of energy. And if you're 50% more, you know, more expensive than the United States, you know, it's just hopeless. You know, you're 30% more expensive than France, which is a fairly sort of similar economy in many ways. You simply can't compete. And we're not addressing that. We're making it worse because, you know, we prioritize net zero. We prioritize, you know, being a global leader on climate change over our industrial base. And maybe we should, you know, I mentioned this in the piece, maybe we should be more honest about that. Maybe the Chancellor and the Energy Secretary should be coming out and saying, listen, the real priority is net zero. If that means we don't have any industry, that's what we're going for. And I suspect Paul and his members will say, you know, hang on a second, you know, and let's go back to the origins of the Labour Party and when it was set up. But that's, you know, that would be a separate issue. But it would be more honest. If you look at things like the increase in national insurance for people who are employing many people, if you look at, you know, the extra levies, like, you know, the industrial electricity charge, surcharge, which is being brought in, you know, they're doubling down on all of that. So they're making it tougher for companies and at a time when they were already really struggling. So I think the government, it was already a bad situation. There was already rapid decline. I think the things the government has done so far has actually made it significantly worse.
Yeah, just come back, because I don't think that Rachel Reeves or Johnny Reynolds or Ed Miliband or anybody else wants to see a deindustrialised Britain. Certainly the TUC and our unions don't. So what can we do about energy costs? Well, in the sort of medium to long term, the government's created Great British Energy, publicly owned energy company. Compare and contrast what happened in France, where EDF is a publicly owned energy company, over the course of the last year. When bills in the UK were going up by 54%, they were going up in France by 4%. So Great British Energy is a longer-term solution. In the short term, we're very clear. We think that there's scope for the government to look at those energy-intensive industries and say we do need to subsidise electricity costs for those industries. Part of the challenges facing steel production or cement, you mentioned, Matthew, or chemicals, is the cost of energy. And our unions will tell you that, the employers will tell you that. And I think there's an onus on the government to do something about that. But in terms of making things worse, I don't think that's borne out by the reality. I mean, you know, one of the first things Rachel Reeves did as Chancellor was that you create that new National Wealth Fund. I say we have got the Industrial Strategy Council now with some serious sort of players around the table. I'm not going to pretend everything is rosy in the garden. But I do think that, you know, we've got a government that is committed to manufacturing and is committed to engineering, is committed to our industrial base. And I think the onus is on everybody, employers, unions, government, working together to secure that future.
Can I come back on that? Well, I mean, with due respect to looking after your members, Paul, because, you know, these are, a lot of these people are your members. And one of the good things we'll miss about manufacturing, which I think we'd agree on, is it provides pretty good jobs and a lot of manual, you know, skilled manual jobs, particularly for men, rather than, you know, the services economy, which is great in its own way, but it tends to be very female. So, you know, in terms of looking after your members and how we improve our manufacturing base, you know, seriously, you know, industrial strategies were the answer. You know, the UK would have the best industrial base of the world. We've been having a different industrial strategies for as long as I can remember, and probably as you can remember.
Seriously, during the last decade and a half, we had serious industrial strategies. As I said, we had a brief flourish under Greg Clark, and then it went incredibly out of fashion in the Tory party.
We'll have a debate another day about industrial strategies, but come back to your point about energy costs. I mean, I think, you know, it's an interesting point about France. You know, they have very significantly lower energy costs than us. I think, you know, that's actually one of the main things. It's absolutely crippling the energy costs in the UK. And I think unless we address that, we are just going to deindustrialize what remains of our industrial base. I don't think, you know, the French have two things. I mean, they had massive subsidies, but as soon as you talk about subsidizing industrial electricity, we're going to have Rachel Reeves saying the black hole. You know, we don't have enough money, leeway, fiscal headspace to massively subsidize industrial electricity. The French also have, you know, very, very large scale nuclear power, you know, which they take a long-term decision. We didn't take that decision. Maybe that was, you know, the Tory party. Maybe it was the Labour party. We could argue about that. But we don't have that. What we actually have to do is lower the industrial cost of electricity, of industrial power. We have to lower our energy costs. So that might mean having more licenses in the North Sea. that might mean fracking. You know, these would be serious answers. I don't think just subsidies from the government is a serious answer, because, you know, it's just going to put more pressure on finances, and then people are going to say, well, we should be spending money on this, and the bond, if we borrow more, you know, the bond markets are going to be in revolt. What we should be doing is having, and what you should be doing for your members, Paul, I think, is having a serious conversation with the government and saying we need lower energy prices, and that probably means more licenses, and that probably means more licenses in the North Sea.
Absolutely, having that serious conversation on behalf of the men and women that we represent right across industry. But let me just say this: I mean, violent agreements and disagreements. I honestly don't think that anybody seriously thinks the fracking is the solution to Britain's energy needs. New nuclear is definitely part of the solution. We've got Hinkley Point about to come on at line over the next few years. We need, crucially, an investment decision, a proper investment decision on Sizewell C, support for that next generation of SMR reactors. That is definitely part of our future. And I have to say, and you know, so this is not a party political point again. Boris Johnson wanged on about building 8 new nuclear power stations and did absolutely nothing about it. Now, I want to say that those nuclear power stations, they're key to securing our industrial base alongside renewables, but they're also a source of good quality jobs in and of themselves as well, and an opportunity to export technology around the world. So I could violently agree with you on that point, Matthew. I can assure you every single day, I mean, one of the things that motivates me, I'll be off down to Westminster shortly, is making sure that we're making a case of good quality jobs for men and women right across our industrial base. And, you know, I'll fight for every single British manufacturing job, whether it's in the defence industries, energy intensive industries, in automotive, where we've got some world leading companies as well. And I am confident about the future of British manufacturing. And I think Britain does need to have that industrial future.
On that point of optimism, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Matthew and Paul.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Lara, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I loved Rory Sutherland's column this week. He says he's got a simple solution to Britain's lack of economic growth. He says that we need to create areas of outstanding natural ugliness where we can build anything. He actually says this is what France does, and it's a complete myth that France is a beautiful country. In fact, it's a glorious mixture of beauty and outright utilitarianism. And we can hear an extract of Rory's column here.
But worst of all, there are simply too many reasons to deny the right to build. Aesthetic, auditory, environmental, ideological, heritage, safety, health. If anyone suggests building a road, which is still easily the best way to grow a local economy, they face a stupid mantra about the need to get people cycling, walking, or taking the train, despite the fact that these are useless for 90% of journeys. Then if you try to start a business on that new road, heaven help you. You know something has gone wrong when Crawley has a Facebook group called Justice for Taco Bell. A fully functioning restaurant opened in the town, only to be closed by the council because they thought the toilets would place a strain on the water supply. Now, I'm no expert in fluidics, but I would assume that unless Tex-Mex food is unusually diuretic, anyone taking a pee in Taco Bell would otherwise be using a toilet nearby, and so the effect on Crawley's water supply should be neutral. Clearly, I'm unqualified for local government work. Fortunately, I have a solution. It's to create AONUs, or Areas of Outstanding Natural Ugliness, where basically anything goes.
Will, what did you like?
I loved the letter from Washington, D.C., written by The Spectator's deputy editor, Freddie Gray, who is out there for the inauguration. And he just gives so many fantastic anecdotes from these various parties he's going to, from his conversations with Liz Truss, to Erickson Moore, with Steve Bannon. There are so many good, funny encounters. And I actually don't want to spoil any of them here. So I really do recommend listeners go away and read that piece for themselves. But it's certainly my favourite thing in the magazine this week.
Well, on the subject of Trump and his inauguration, it's no secret that the Trump administration isn't that popular with numerous foreign leaders. But in the magazine this week, Damian Thompson, who's the host of The Spectator's Holy Smoke podcast, writes about a surprising spat between Trump and the Pope. The Vatican has announced the appointment of an outspoken liberal, Cardinal Robert McElroy, as the new Archbishop of Washington. And as Damien explains, this seems to be somewhat in retaliation at Trump announcing the selection of an uncompromising pro-life, pro-MAGA ambassador to the Holy See. Far from being above such vengeance, Damien writes that the Pope is one of the most relentless score settlers in the history of the papacy. We were joined by Damien to unpack this, alongside our deputy editor, Freddie Gray. I started by asking Damien why Robert McElroy is such a controversial figure in Catholic circles.
It's an extraordinary story of tit for tat. Bob McElroy, known to traditionalists as the Wicked Witch of the West, is a highly unusual figure. Basically, he is the most left-wing bishop in the United States, probably. Hardline, dogmatic, jargon-spouting, lefty Trump-hater. Very ambitious, now in his 70s, but his promotion has indicated to what extent the Pope enjoys score-settling and tit-for-tat manoeuvres. He was promoted. He was given a cardinal's hat, even though he was in the relatively minor see of San Diego, basically as a way of annoying his boss, the Metropolitan Archbishop of Los Angeles, Archbishop Gomez, whom the Pope doesn't like. So this relatively junior Bishop of San Diego gets given a cardinal's hat, which is unknown. So that was 2-3 years ago. Then Wilton Gregory, who's Archbishop of Washington, is up for retirement. So Francis was looking for a new Archbishop of Washington, and he was advised by his own nuncio, Cardinal Pierre, definitely one who does the Pope's bidding, McElroy's too divisive because he's so left-wing. He likes cancelling Latin masses. He's endlessly preaching against Trump. He's endlessly spouting jargon, and he's just not liked by most of his fellow bishops. And Francis decided I'm not going to give the thing to McElroy because it's annoyed so much that I've made him a cardinal in this relatively junior job and nobody likes him. And yes, okay, maybe it's too polarizing. So Trump gets elected. And of course, Pope Francis is furious about that because the two men can't stand each other. He particularly loathes Trump. And Trump announces that his ambassador to the Holy See is going to be Brian Birch, founder of CatholicVote.org, which is a pretty hardline pro-life and pro-Republican lobby group. Very effective. And Francis thought, right, by all accounts, very well-sourced accounts, that's the point at which he decided to change his mind and put McElroy in Washington, which is a real, it's not just a slap down to the administration, it's a slap down to the clergy of Washington, D.C., who on the whole are orthodox, if not conservative. And I am sure voted overwhelmingly for Trump, because after all, even among nominal Catholics, Trump beat Harris by 15 points. He beat Biden by 5 points in 2000. So it's a political appointment, but it's a very, very bad one for a reason that's kind of separate, which is that McElroy has a very, very troubling CV.
Well, Freddie, quite apart from what the Pope may think about Trump, as Damien mentioned, Trump does do very well with Catholics and won the Catholic vote very solidly this time around, and even won it last time around up against Joe Biden, who is himself a Catholic. What do you think is Trump's appeal among a great many Catholic voters? Is it as simple as the abortion issue, or is there something else that means that Trump has this hold on the Catholic vote in America?
Yeah, I think Trump speaks very much culturally, if that's the right word, to a lot of American Catholics, blue-collar Irish Catholics, Italian Catholics, in states, swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And in fact, you know, he did beat Biden with the Catholic vote, but Biden did, although I think according to some polls, Biden did actually pip him. But would the reason Biden won in 2020, I mean, some people will say he didn't, but the reason he did is because he was able to win back a large share of that Catholic vote that Trump took from Hillary, despite Hillary having a Catholic vice president in 2016. So Trump appeals culturally to Catholics. And actually, I don't think the abortion issue, obviously, you know, a lot of the pro-life movement are grateful to Trump for having changed the Supreme Court, which led to the reversal of Dobbs. But I think Catholics who are interested in the life issue, and there are a lot of them, obviously, they will vote for Trump over Kamala Harris because that's, you know, a very clear choice for them. But they are not entirely happy with what's happened since Dobbs. And they're not entirely happy with Trump's position on abortion because Trump actually is, by Catholic standards, pro-choice.
Hmm. Well, Freddie, you've been in D.C. this week for Trump's inauguration. And a story that's just come out this week is that it's not, of course, just McElroy who seems to dislike the Trump administration, the incoming Trump administration, because another bishop, this time an Anglican bishop, Marianne Budd of the Episcopal Church, the Bishop of Washington for the Episcopal Church, had this controversial moment where she appealed to Trump to have mercy on LGBT children and immigrants. And it doesn't seem like Trump and J.D. Vance were particularly happy about that. We can hear an extract now from that sermon.
Let me make one final plea, Mr. President. Millions have put their trust in you. And as you told the nation yesterday, you have felt the providential hand of a loving God. In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now. There are gay, lesbian, and transgender children in Democratic, Republican, and independent families, some who fear for their lives. I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away.
What did you make of that moment, Freddie? That sort of appeal doesn't seem like it's going to go down very well with Trump, does it?
I love that moment. I love the video, and I encourage all listeners to this to watch the video as well if they haven't already, because it perfectly sums up what happened in Washington this week. Washington is full of churches that are really kind of LGBTQ shrines. And on the Episcopalian wing, on the Catholic wing, on other wings, it's a very, very liberal city, and they worship progressive politics as much as they do God. And with Marianne Budd's little lecture there, you saw exactly what they are all about. They are the spiritual arm of the Democratic Party. And it was just very, very funny looking at Trump and Vance looking very nonplussed. And I have to say, you don't have to be a Trump or Vance fan, I don't think, to be on their side while looking at that video.
Can I make one point about the difference between Marianne Budd and Robert McElroy? I mean, their views are very similar. But she's the bishop of a moribund, minuscule sect, which is what the Episcopal Church has become in America now, with about, you know, about 150 members or whatever it is, God knows. And of course, they're all super, in Washington, they're all identikit liberals. McElroy is going to be taking charge of a diocese where there's a lot of conservative Catholics. Washington is a sort of hub of this small but very significant renewed, often Latin Mass-based conservative Catholicism. Certainly Orthodox, even if it's not into the Latin Mass. Certainly not turned on by the sort of politicized, soporific jargon that McElroy specializes in. So McElroy, unlike Budd, is really going to be at odds with his many people in his flock, and certainly his own clergy. So it's a very sadistic appointment, I think, by Francis, and I don't think it's going to end happily.
And Fred, just to finish, you've obviously been in DC this week. Were there any other moments from the inauguration, in a kind of religious sense, that you found particularly striking?
Well, I loved the contribution at a prayer, I think it was, from Lorenzo Sewell, I think his name is, who's a charismatic black pastor. And he gave this amazing sort of very, he used the word Negro spiritual, which is a controversial term, but a really powerful bit of oratory, I thought, and very, very touching and sort of amazingly over the top, almost comic, but also quite moving, I thought.
Well, let's listen to a clip from that as well now.
Heavenly Father, in the name of Jesus, we are so grateful today that you will use our 47th president so we would sing with new meaning, my country, 'tis of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and because America is called to be a great nation, we believe that you will make this come true. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous hilltops of California, but God, we're asking you not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and every molehill in Mississippi, from every state, every city, every village, and every hamlet. And when we let freedom ring, we will be able to speed up that day where all of your children, black men and white men, Protestant and Catholic, Jew and Gentile, will be able to sing in the meaning of that old Negro spiritual, free at last. Free at last. Thank you, God Almighty. We are free at last. If you believe what the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Come on, put your hands together and give your great God great glory.
And finally, on to the subject of sex parties. In this week's issue, James Innes-Smith takes us through what seems to be the fairly depressing reality of them. He says that far from being upmarket affairs, James claims the organisers clearly exaggerate expectations and the quality of the applicants, himself included. Most attendees leave feeling slightly depressed and somewhat unfulfilled. So why do people keep going to them? James joined us to discuss alongside Sophia Money-Coutts, the former features director of Tatler magazine, who has also written about sex parties. James, in the magazine this week, you write about what you call the depressing reality of sex parties. Could you start by telling listeners about your experience and why you went to a sex party in the first place and what you wanted to get out of the experience?
Well, I got in. A friend of mine got in touch, just thinking it would be fun to go. And she, as a journalist, she sort of knew that I was up for a bit of an adventure. So I agreed. She was much younger than me, but she kind of sold it quite well to me. So I decided to go along. And yeah, it was very much sold as a sort of quite elite party. It was in a beautiful house, and you know there were all sorts of tests that you supposedly had to go through in order to be qualified enough to go there. Unfortunately, that all seemed to be a bit of a kind of affectation, really, because the sort of people who were there were very much your sort of regular, I wouldn't have called them sexual elite, as was what they described them as being. They were more sort of your average, you know, nice middle-class people from the provinces, which was fine, but it wasn't quite the sort of glamour models that I was kind of expecting.
And you say there's something endearingly English about the sex party you went to. What made it feel like an English sex party as opposed to any other country?
A French one, maybe.
There was that sweet sort of embarrassment and awkwardness, nobody quite knowing what to do. I think I mentioned in the piece, we were, you know, should we be engaging in small talk or you know, ripping each other's clothes off? It wasn't really clear how we were meant to be, and nobody really knew. And I suppose English people being quite reticent on the whole, we sort of stood around feeling embarrassed. But and even when we were presented with this large bed with people sort of making out on it, everyone sort of had their backs to the bed as if nothing was going on and pretending it wasn't happening, which I think is another quite endearing English trait. You know, when embarrassment hits, you just pretend it's not happening.
Well, I must say, James, in an issue of The Spectator, which also includes a piece about the death of British manufacturing, I think your piece managed to depress me more than any other piece that we've run this week. Something which really struck me about your piece was the idea that there's a sort of tragedy to the desire for this sort of a thing. Is it possible, do you think, to have a sex party that isn't a little bit tragic and depressing?
I think if it happens organically, yes, I think probably it could be quite exciting if you're at a party and it sort of heads that way and everyone's sort of in agreement and it just naturally happens. I think, well, why not? But the problem with an organized sex party where you're actually handing over quite a lot of money is that there's a lot of expectation. Even before you go in, everyone's sort of very anxious. And I mean, when we were queuing up to go in, and of course, expectations are very high. And I think when your expectations are high, they're usually disappointed because it's hard to live up to. And I think especially with something like sex, which is so much to do with imagination and, you know, complicated things to do with how you get on with someone and all that natural sort of desire and falling into stuff. Just it just disappears, and there's this feeling that you should be having sex with people, even though you're not necessarily feeling very sexually allured, if that's a word.
Safar, I think I'm right in saying that you have also been to a sex party.
I have. What, for work.
For work, for work, of course.
Of course.
Much like James, James is going for work.
It's a tough living, but someone's got to do it.
Could you tell us about your experience? And did you also find, at the party you went to, which I assume was in this country, did you also find there to be a sort of quite kind of quintessential English reluctance to join in?
No, actually, in a word. I went a few years ago. I was working at Tatler at the time, and it was when 50 Shades of Grey was coming out, and we decided that the way we would tackle this important subject was for me to write a piece about posh S&M. And for some reason, this involved me being sent to a party which is known as Torture Garden, which some listeners may be familiar with, some may not. And unfortunately, for my deadline, the only one that worked was the more intimate Torture Garden, which was on a barge on the Thames. And I managed to persuade a friend of mine. You could get off the barge, though, quite crucially. It was moored. I persuaded a friend of mine who'd been once before to come with me. And I borrowed from a fashion brand a latex catsuit. I slightly fibbed and said it was for a photo shoot. I didn't actually tell them I was taking it to a sex party because I didn't think they would lend it to me then. So we got on this barge, and quite early on, it was pretty clear that there was not very much reticence going on at all. I mean, maybe there were fewer Brits and more Europeans on this barge. I don't know. There's a whole area sort of below decks. There was a whole area. I think someone later said, oh, that's the dungeon bit.
Well, if it's below decks, that makes sense, you know.
Yeah, the sex dungeon.
Yeah.
It was set up with, it looked to me like old school gym apparatus, sort of pommel horses and things. And it was dark, but you could tell that things were happening on this apparatus. And my friend and I nearly said her name then, I will withhold it for her privacy. We sort of sat on the benches nervously surveying all of this, which you could do. There was no pressure to join in. And then I think there was a moment when we were both whipped with a horsehair whip briefly. But again, it wasn't very titillating, wasn't very exciting. Anyway, then I think we went back to the bar and had a ropey bottle of Prosecco and left. But there was a lot of stuff going on that. The thing that I really remember though was the smell. James, I don't know if you found this at your sex party. At my sex party, the smell on the boat of sort of sweat and BO and hormones and everything was so disgusting. And I spoke to a friend of mine afterwards, a very old friend of mine who used to provide security for such parties in the 80s and 90s. And he said, in the days when you were allowed to smoke inside, it was way better because that masked the smell of sweat and bodies and hormones and all of that. So I had a sort of interesting time. And as I wrote in my subsequent piece, I think, for Tatler, I said, you know, it beats a Friday night in the pub in Fulham. But I wasn't necessarily racing to go back either.
Yeah, I suppose, yes, a pub in Fulham or sex party. Are those the only choices? But Sophia, what do you think of the kind of thesis of James's piece, that there is a sort of underlying tragedy to, in a sense, to this kind of organised sex party? Is that a sense that you got as well when you were there? A sort of slightly odd, maybe slightly depressing feel to the whole thing?
No, in a way, the party that I went to, because it's also about fetishes, I think, Torture Garden. So it allows people to explore certain things, and everyone was in very different outfits. There were a lot of men in sort of leather lederhosen, for example. So actually that, in a way, was an outlet, I suppose, for certain people to explore what they were into, and that could be quite liberating. I think these days, and that party was about 9 years ago, I think these days there is, James is right, particularly because everyone bangs on about sort of connection these days, don't they? Particularly when it comes to the awfulness of dating apps and ghosting and all those things which we are now, those of us who are single, are sort of dealing with. I do think there is a slight tragedy to going to these things seeking some form of connection, and actually you feel less connected in the end than you might do otherwise, and more depressed about the state of one's own love life or sex life.
I think sex is a poor substitute. Well, it can seem so alluring, but actually, if what's missing in your life is intimacy, then I think you're certainly not going to find it. And also, if you're struggling to find intimacy with your actual partner, to then think you're going to find it through having sex with a bunch of strangers, I think is going to just make matters worse in many ways, because you'll suddenly realize that intimacy is quite a complex thing that takes time, and it's not something you can just instantly get through cheap thrills.
James, can I ask you, I wrote about sex parties a few years ago for The Spectator.
Am I the only one who hasn't written about sex parties?
It's Friday night, do it.
I've never been to a sex party, but one of the things I noticed was people telling me they were going to sex parties, and it made me feel kind of like I was getting older somehow. And I wonder, do you think sex parties are the kind of preserve of middle age, much like, I don't know, golf or bridge? I mean, is that the reality? Because I don't think younger people go to them as much. Is that fair?
Most of the people I met there were couples who were struggling. They'd, you know, their sex lives had either become boring or they were non-existent. And I think, you know, it was quite sad, in as much as they thought they were going to go there in order to try and rekindle something which had gone. And I, as I say in the piece, actually, at the end of the party, when I went and just chatted, we were sitting around chatting to everyone, it was remarkable how little sex had actually taken place. Most people had been happy just to sit around and chat and meet new people. And it made me think, well, maybe that's actually what's missing in your life. It's just friendships and closeness. And they didn't actually, I mean, it would have been a much more successful party probably if their sex element had been removed, ironically, I reckon.
Well, Sophia and James, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, why not pick up a copy of the magazine to read all the articles we talked about in full? And if you do enjoy the podcast, please click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we do hope you join us again next week.